I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The quality of places results from many factors. Today we're going to talk to two experts in very different fields, both of whom are deeply engaged in making better places. Maria Hibbs directs the Partnership for New Communities, the Chicago Brain Trust that is working alongside Chicago Housing Authority to transform the city's neighborhoods that formerly housed towers of public housing residents. Paul Lucas is focused on remaking suburbs. He's using his adaptive design process to uncover local idiosyncrasies and reintroduce them into the planning and development of suburban monocultures. We'll be back with this week's edition of Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Maria Hibbs is the Executive Director of the Partnership for New Communities, a fund of the Chicago Community Trust dedicated to making Chicago a city in which each neighborhood is a thriving community with economic and racial diversity and strong institutions that enable all residents to participate fully in community life. Maria joined the partnership after more than 20 years managing the public and governmental affairs and corporate communications functions of major Fortune 500 companies in the Chicagoland area. Maria described the Chicago Housing Authority's plan for transformation.
The Chicago Housing Authority's plan for transformation is an effort to rebuild the built environment in which residents of public housing live, but also help to transform their lives. And it involves the redevelopment or rehabilitation of 25,000 units of housing. About 7,000 of those units of housing will be within the context of mixed income settings. So in those mixed income developments, there will be a third public housing, a third affordable housing, and then a third market rate housing. And those mixed income settings are where large public housing developments once stood. So there were thousands of units of public housing concentrated in certain neighborhoods in Chicago, many of them high-rises that have been demolished or are in the process of being demolished and replaced with mixed-income housing. But we can't lose sight of the fact that in addition to that public housing stock, the CHA is also rehabilitating all of its other public housing stock as well for seniors and for families.
It began in 2000. What has been accomplished to date?
So it's a 15-year plan, and by the end of 2007, over 65,000 units of housing will be brought back online. So 65% of the public housing that is either being rehabilitated or constructed new within the mixed income settings will be brought back online.
What was it about the plan for transformation that so excited the private and philanthropic sectors in Chicago?
Early on in the plan for transformation, there were leaders in the business community and in the philanthropic community in particular that saw this as a real opportunity to leverage immense public investment to revitalize sections of the city that for decades had some of the largest concentrations of poverty in this country. So they had a platform upon which to build and to truly revitalize hundreds of acres of the city, and not only revitalize places, but to rethink the way people within those places live. Part of the intellectual underpinning of the Partnership for New Communities is some of the work that William Julius Wilson has done, in particular, the disappearance of work. And in these communities, there was enormous disinvestment over the decades. So there were not places within a community to work, or very few places within a community to work. And in addition to that, there were many people who couldn't work or didn't work. And so there were generations of people in some cases that had never had a job or never knew anyone who had a job. And that has a tremendous debilitating impact on a neighborhood. And so the civic and business leaders who started the Partnership for New Communities understood that the economic infrastructure within these neighborhoods needed to be rebuilt, in addition to rebuilding the real estate, so to speak. And what excited them was the potential for having a dramatic, making a dramatic change in Chicago, but also in serving for a model for other cities that may be undergoing public housing transformation or some other large-scale civic endeavor that would benefit from bringing together civic and business leaders to help effect and help move forward. And so that's what excited them about becoming a part of the plan for transformation and a part of the partnership in the process. The In addition to these civic and business leaders understanding that they could have a role to play, the mayor was also very, very dedicated to engaging various sectors to have an impact on the plan for transformation. He said from the beginning, this is not something that the CHA can do alone. It is not something that city government can do alone. It's not anything that government by itself can do. It has to involve the public sector, but also the private sector, corporate, philanthropic, and other nonprofits. And so the Partnership for New Communities brings together CEOs of various kinds of organizations, from the University of Chicago to large corporations in Chicago to the Archdiocese of Chicago. So Cardinal George is on our board as well. And so we bring together those perspectives, and all of them have something to bring to the effort. They may bring philanthropic dollars and investment. Some of them may bring corporate investment to these communities, which we find particularly exciting. And some of them bring thought leadership to the effort. So all of them together really catalyze other investment, involvement, interest on the part of the city's leadership.
You are investing in individuals and in places to make them economic contributors. Tell me what you're doing with individuals.
One of the objectives of the plan for transformation is to help the residents of public housing qualify to live in the new mixed income developments. So there are certain requirements to move back to the new developments, and those requirements were set by working groups of residents, developers, others in the community, to and they decided on their own what kinds of site-specific criteria they wanted to impose so that the mixed-income developments are sustainable and attractive places to live. So one of them is a requirement to work 30 hours a week or be engaged in either training or career education at least 30 hours a week. So the partnership, in conjunction with and collaboration with the Housing Authority and the Mayor's Office of Workforce Development, established a major workforce development initiative called Opportunity Chicago. It's a $23 million initiative, which will run for 5 years. We are now completing year two, and our goal is to place 5,000 public housing residents in work in those 5 years, and we aim that those jobs would be career path types of jobs, career advancement with benefits, And so the effort is a comprehensive initiative that helps to prepare, place, and help public housing residents retain their work or move up on a career ladder. And the $23 million initiative is both public and private money. The private money is through the Partnership for New Communities. So we're raising $5 million from private sources to dedicate to the project. And that $5 million has leveraged $18 million in public money from various levels of government, both local as well as national and federal and state. And so after the first 2 years of this comprehensive strategy, we have exceeded our goals for both of those years. First year placed over 1,300 public housing residents in jobs. And then this year we're tracking to do about the same. What's interesting about this year is that the number of new participants has increased. And so of those 1,300, as you can imagine, sometimes people will cycle through several jobs before they hit on one that they're going to stick with for a while or move up within a company or an organization. And so what was interesting to us is we had, as of about September, more than 600 new clients, new participants. So it's not all this, you know, the same people cycling through until they hit a position or an organization that they'll remain with. It's other people coming into the program and participating, which is our objective and which is exciting. So in addition to the placement and retention efforts, there is, of course, also a heavy emphasis on preparation. And the initiative has worked closely with the City Colleges of Chicago, other workforce development providers to prepare people for work and, again, to set people on a career path.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Maria Hibbs. She is director of the Partnership for New Communities in Chicago. Where are the people you are training and placing in jobs living now?
Some are living in public housing that hasn't been demolished. Some are living in the private market with a housing choice voucher. And so individuals had several choices temporarily and permanently. And temporarily, they could take a housing choice voucher and with that temporary voucher live in a community until their new housing unit is completed. Or they could live elsewhere in public housing until the new housing is completed.
What are the biggest barriers you've encountered to job training and placement?
The biggest barriers we've encountered are lack of work experience or sporadic work experience and low skill levels. Those are tremendous barriers. Also, childcare is a barrier, and so we're working with the Housing Authority and with other government agencies, as well as nonprofit agencies that have child care services within the communities to offer child care so that people can go to work and feel comfortable that their children are being well cared for. But that's an enormous barrier. But on the preparation side, I went into this, I come from 20 plus years in corporate life. So I was very interested in matching people with the right employer in the right job. And it was inconceivable to me that people wouldn't be prepared for the kinds of job entry-level positions that were available. And so this initiative has been humbling for me because I realize just how many barriers people have and what they have to overcome in order to take that first job and take that first step. And You know, in many ways, it would be like asking me to become a neurosurgeon in a year. And so sometimes you have to, you know, people have to work up in smaller steps, smaller increments, achieving goals that they can achieve over a shorter period of time and then move up. So I'll tell you a story. We had had members of our board offer to hire public housing residents in their organizations. And one of those marvelous employers was Peoples Gas, the gas distribution company here in Chicago. And they had entry-level positions in their call center. Now, you can imagine that their call center is the public face of the company to their customers. And so while those are entry-level positions, they are not necessarily entry-level positions for a lot of the people with whom we're working, because those are individuals who may never have had a job before. So prior to Opportunity Chicago, the way that individuals sought jobs was through a system of social service providers called service connectors in their community. And actually, we still work through the service connectors to link people to job opportunities. But before Opportunity Chicago had started, and one of the reasons, in fact, that Opportunity Chicago became imperative was the individuals who went to Peoples Gas to interview for the positions were not well prepared for those interviews. A number of them could not pass the testing required. And in other cases, some people just didn't interview well, so they weren't prepared for the interview. Some of them were communications issues. Their service connector may not have told them the kind of position they'd be interviewing for. From that, we had the CEO of Peoples Gas who said, okay, we've learned a lot from this. Now, how are we going to apply it? And we'll give it another chance. And from that first experience arose the commitment, the imperative to create Opportunity Chicago. And also the, you know, desire to develop a comprehensive set of services, and also what's even more important than the services that are being provided is the collaboration among public agencies, the not-for-profits who provide some of the services, and aligning public systems to work together to more efficiently and effectively serve the people we're attempting to serve.
Describe for me what the Partnership for New Communities does.
So early on in the plan for transformation, the civic community and the mayor and others realized that city government, the public sector alone, couldn't affect the kind of transformation that they were attempting to. And so in 2001, they established the Partnership for New Communities. And the founders of the partnership are the MacArthur Foundation and the Chicago Community Trust, which is Chicago's community foundation, recruited a number of other civic leaders to participate. And in 2003, I was brought on board to help provide the structure and the day-to-day operation of the partnership. And really, the partnership does four things. It first provides advice and counsel to the Chicago Housing Authority. It does so in a setting that is supportive of the goals of the plan for transformation. As you can imagine, something as ambitious as the plan for transformation has had some controversy associated with it and some bumps along the road. So this group provides advice to the Housing Authority's leadership. The individuals who participate in the partnership are also thought leaders in the community, and so they communicate with their peers about what's happening in these neighborhoods and how Chicago is being revitalized through the plan for transformation and the impact that it's having on the city as a whole. Third, the partnership raises money and makes grants within the communities of focus, those communities that are being revitalized through the Plan for Transformation. And our two key programmatic areas are economic development and workforce development. And fourth, the institutions themselves that are represented around the table at the partnership make investments of their own or are engaged in their own in some ways. And so we have several examples of that. The MacArthur Foundation and the Chicago Community Trust have their own grant making that may focus on research and public housing transformation and community development, and also their own grant making and providing services to community residents, community building activities. So philanthropy is involved through the partnership, but also on its own.
How do you keep the redevelopment of places and the transformation of the lives of people in alignment?
Making better lives for people in the community and redeveloping neighborhoods, there is a natural tension there, and it's a delicate balance. One of the things the partnership does is we have commissioned the Metro Chicago Information Center to track community change over time so that from year to year we could see how or whether incomes are increasing, whether what I would call unhealthy gentrification is taking place. That kind of data, that kind of evidence will help us prevent some of the wholesale displacement that could take place and is taking place in many neighborhoods in Chicago and elsewhere.
What has proven to be the toughest part of your assignment?
One of the toughest parts of my assignment, and I say this in jest, but it is difficult, is scheduling a meeting with my board. If you can imagine, they are the busiest people in Chicago, and their travels take them all over the world. And so just in order to conduct the business that we have to conduct with them, that's a huge challenge. But more seriously, the biggest challenges, I think, involve the engagement of residents in preparing to return and be eligible for housing in the mixed income developments.
Maria Hibbs is Executive Director of the Partnership for New Communities. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Plan Edison Assistant Editor Nate Berg.
The city of Chicago recently announced an innovative plan to reduce its water waste. By retrofitting its nearly 2,000 miles worth of alleyways with permeable and porous pavements, the city will allow stormwater to actually drain back into the earth instead of into a gutter. The New York Times reports that the city will have reworked 46 of these green alleys by the end of 2007 and expects to install the same permeable pavements in all alleys needing refurbishing. The costs of this plan are taking some heat from residents, especially those who note that the city's recycling program is practically non-existent. But proponents argue that prices for permeable pavements have gone way down in recent years, making them competitive with traditional asphalts, and representing a passive way for the city to conserve and treat water naturally, as opposed to the millions it takes to treat this drain water in a wastewater facility. And while Chicago looks to reclaim its water, residents in central Ohio are trying to reclaim their neighborhoods. Groups of residents are pooling funds in the Ohio communities of College Hill and Springfield Township to buy up foreclosed properties. They are doing this, they say, to prevent real estate prospectors, or flippers, from coming into town and snatching up properties, only to redevelop them and resell them for a quick profit. The Cincinnati Inquirer reports that these community groups are moving first, buying up properties from sheriff's auctions in the hopes that keeping the properties locally and sometimes publicly owned will prevent unwanted uses and possible future foreclosures due to the short-sighted investments of these prospectors. And in Fresno, California, recently rediscovered underground tunnels have sparked a blaze of interest in preserving the intricate system and debunking the mystery about why it was made. Fresno's tunnels were built beneath the city's historic Chinatown in the early part of the century, and as the Los Angeles Times reports, similar underground passageways have been rumored to exist in the Chinatowns of other California cities as well. Though the history of Fresno's Chinatown tunnels has no comprehensive documentation, some say the tunnels were used as portals to brothels and speakeasies. Others, however, dispute these rumors, arguing that they were merely used as convenient avenues for transporting and delivering goods from building to building. Whatever their true purpose, Fresno's tunnels will continue to be explored, toured, and preserved as a relic of early Chinese immigrant culture in the city. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk to Paul Lucas, author of Suburban Transformations. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Paul Lucas is principal with Paul Lucas Architecture and Transform X. He has worked in the field of architecture and urban design since 1978 and has taught architecture design at MIT, Miami University, Roger Williams University, and Boston Architectural Center. He is author of Suburban Transformations from Princeton Architectural Press. Paul, you write that the quality of unique identity is lacking in current suburban context. And most of us would agree with that. What are the factors that led to this lack of distinctiveness?
I think it's a very good question. There's probably many factors that contribute to it. One is based on economic models that are used by developers and corporations and how they use land. And very often a certain building type would be used for, let's say, a shopping mall or a fast food restaurant that might be very useful to use around the country. And so it's easy for developers to repeat and use the same kind of building type in each site, no matter where the context is. So consequently, there's kind of a quality of sameness that can result from this approach, where you could go to one mall in one part of the country and it would look identical to another kind of mall or another kind of fast food place. And so that's one of the contributing factors to how we use our land. Another is that we haven't, as I think, as communities and residents invested in our communities, thought much about what is actually happening to our land and being able to monitor and test whether or not what's being built is really consistent with the way we would like to see our land developed. And the result of many development patterns has actually been, I would say, in some cases, a desecration of the landscape, where often the landscape is damaged because of certain building types and development models, which tend to favor large expanses of asphalt and non-pervious surfaces. As a result, traces of the landscape or history are often removed.
So how is – what's a better way? Describe a better way. How is the identity of places developed?
Well, my contention is that if we look at some really – memorable places that anyone has ever been to or visited, whether it's in this country or in other countries, there's a quality about these places that are unique. And often many of these kinds of communities, towns, or special locations have a really interesting connection to the landscape or the history. And so I think that's one of the first steps, is thinking about how can we connect the way our communities continue to evolve and develop in such a way that they relate more strongly to the landscape. If, for instance, you go to one part of the country, let's say the South, which has a certain kind of vegetation or ecology, if we can relate more strongly to those kinds of contexts and be able to differentiate that from, let's say, someplace in the Northwest, those are the beginnings of how we can think about relating more strongly to the landscape. And secondly, thinking about what type of materials we use, what kinds of building types we use, and how they're configured and shaped to reflect the local community spirit, the local community history, the local community needs. So as much as possible, trying to think about how local conditions can begin to influence the development of edge cities and suburbs.
It's I think in some cases we've forgotten how to even think about local conditions. You've mentioned landscape. You've mentioned building materials and how buildings are how building materials are used. Are there other things on the checklist that we need to learn about before we decide to develop?
Oh, yes. I mean, in many cases, what we discover in especially places where, let's say, strip malls are developed or large shopping malls, some of the things that happen in the development patterns is actually that that large expanses of the landscape are reduced or removed, or even, in fact, aquifers in the hydrology of the landscape can be removed. And all of this is because we have enormous engineering possibilities and we can manipulate the landscape in any way we like. And I think this is something we need to look at and say, is this the best way to develop our land? Is this the best way to use our natural resources? And are there other ways of developing, creating developments which are more eco-friendly and more consistent with the needs of a community?
And is that up to planners to consider? Can you get the general public conditioned to think about these things and make their voices heard? I mean, where does the change come?
Well, the change can come in many different levels. And this is one of the things that the book tries to address and appeal to. First of all, obviously, developers are the built-in advocates for the environment. Of course, the power that each developer has depends on each community and how the community's planning structure is organized. But secondly, there's advocacy that's possible through on the part of communities. Communities can organize themselves. They can think about how developments impact them. The development patterns are such today with sprawl that even places that are maybe 1 to 3 miles away from current edge city conditions or strip malls could within 5 to 20 years itself be right next to major developments. And who wants to have a large parking lot or shopping mall right behind their backyard? And these are patterns that are happening around the country. So communities can mobilize and start demanding of their governments that they start looking at these kinds of issues more closely. Secondly, I think there's a real value in the part of developers and shopping mall developers and corporate entities to think about what their impact is on the landscape, how they can present to the public a greener and more sustainable presence. This has marketing value for companies and corporations. I mean, we see now that under the direct leadership of the president of Walmart, that Walmart is making a major change in how they're starting to present themselves as a more a sustainable company, how they're thinking about their markets, their products, their buildings, their parking lots. It goes throughout the corporation. And this is something in the future that's just going to be necessary of all major corporations and developers. And the sooner that they can step on the bandwagon and start working in this way, the sooner that they will have a distinctive and competitive advantage in the marketplace.
You at once applaud new urbanism for its impact on suburban places, but you also slap it for producing predictable designs that are less likely to incorporate these local idiosyncrasies that you're speaking of, individual expression and contemporary architecture. In your opinion, why has new urbanism not yet achieved what you believe is the potential of placemaking?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to compliment and laud the achievements of the new urbanist movement under Stuanes and Plotter Zybrook's directorship, along with Calthorpe and many others. I think they've done enormous things to raise the awareness of the general public and the development public, the developer market, and so on, and thinking about new models for development in the suburbs and exurbs, as well as urban contexts. Their emphasis is on trying to create places that have a strong fabric of streets and building typologies. They have very positive spaces that people can use throughout their days, having a mix of uses and so on. All of these things are tremendously positive, and I don't want to take anything away from that. I think one of the things that has resulted in the development of the new urbanist movement is that there is obviously a real interest in looking at historic models of development. I'm talking about models from the late 19th century, early 20th century of towns and town development patterns that are very, very ideal in many ways. And those models sometimes get replicated in certain developments, in contemporary developments. And there's a little bit of a disconnect in some cases in terms of relationship between the model, the original precedent, and the site where the model is being tested. And so what we're asking is saying, well, look, can we use some of the patterns and ideals of the new urbanist model and apply them to contemporary situations, which sometimes are messy? And I'm actually saying that, look, sometimes we can take these messy conditions. We can take an off-ramp or an existing building which might not be exactly in the right place, and we can actually incorporate it into the evolving fabric of a city or a suburb. And it's actually these kinds of idiosyncrasies that make places unique and different. So that when you look at, for instance, Burlington or Tyson's Corner or other places around the country, that each place would have its own kind of unique character and quality that's the result of how development patterns have played themselves out over time on a particular site.
I can imagine that developers who are looking to work efficiently and profitably would say, well, that's a great idea, Paul, but we need to be able to duplicate a pattern so that it doesn't take us as much time or as much design. I mean, we're trying to move fast here. So whose responsibility? I'm just wondering, is it really reasonable to expect developers to respond to local idiosyncrasies, or is that really up to local citizens?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And first of all, to answer the second part of your question, I think obviously the community needs to take interest in what happens to their communities and how they get changed. So, for instance, in Framingham and Natick, where one of the first malls was developed in Shoppers World.
Now, that's in Massachusetts.
That's correct. That's okay. In Massachusetts. It's one of the first malls that was built in the 1950s, early 1950s. It had a very unique structure. And parts of it, it's very futuristic. And parts of it were actually, one could argue, historically noteworthy and could have been incorporated into future developments. In fact, there was a movement on the part of many citizens to try to save it. Instead, the developers tore down this mall that was less than 50 years old and decided to wipe the slate clean. I think there would have been possibilities to take parts of the original building and incorporate it into some kind of new structure. That would have made that mall in particular very distinctive and would have given a marketing value to the developer. They could have said, look, this is Shoppers World Revisited or Shoppers World 2, or give it some kind of quality that would have made people realize, you know, this is different than the mall 3 miles down the road. So that's one point. Secondly, I think long term we're going to discover that there's going to become an increasing awareness on the part of developers and builders to think about how they use natural resources and how they use their design and engineering services, how they use the structure of buildings, so that if they build a building, instead of thinking of it being torn down in 10, 20 years, instead it might be there, or parts of it might be there, for 50 or 100 years, that we can design structures that are more adaptable and sustainable over time, so that a certain superstructure might be able to be used for many different kinds of retail models or retail and housing models or a range of different uses, which will allow a place to have more value. So instead of tearing down malls, tearing down all these buildings every 5 to 20 years, we can in fact build for the future. And that saves a lot of resources and makes the sites more valuable. And so there's a real economic incentive there, I think, in thinking about how structures can change. And through our studies and research at MIT, one of the things we were actually looking at is how the design of certain buildings and where you position buildings can create higher probabilities of those buildings being able to withstand the tests of time. In other words, that if you build a building in a certain relationship to a street, the way you position it can indicate whether the building might be around for 5 years, 10 years, or whether it has a chance of withstanding the tests of time over 50 and 100 years. So there's certain probabilities that we can begin to examine in what the likelihood of certain building shapes and configurations can yield long-term for a developer or a community.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Paul Lucas. He is author of Suburban Transformations from Princeton Architectural Press. And can you codify that so that there's general wisdom or knowledge around this issue, and then communities can assume if it works there, it works here? Or again, is this a matter of local idiosyncrasies?
Well, the idea is actually to say or take these more codified generic patterns that have been demonstrated over time and then apply them to local conditions so that they can be adjusted to the local circumstances. Let me give you an example. So, for instance, 2,000 years ago, when market structures were being built in Rome and other places like Trajan's Market, for instance, in Rome, there was a certain pattern to how that building was developed. And it's based on a repetitive series of bays which service the retail or the market stalls of that particular period in time. Buildings of this type throughout Roman subsequent generations then were transformed and used for many different kinds of uses. Some of those buildings actually survived for up to 2,000 years. More recently, for instance, in Boston, we have Quincy Markets that was over 200 years old and was in danger of being torn down in 1976. But Ben Thompson and Rouse Development Company were able to figure out how to reuse that building and use it to really regenerate parts of the city. It's been a huge success. One of the reasons I think that building survived was because the building was very adaptable to change. It was a building that not only served as a market over its life, but also served as warehouses, offices, in some cases residential uses. So there's many different ways in which we can think about generic building patterns and how they can be applied to local site conditions that can create very interesting combinations that both deal with long-term needs but also express the idiosyncrasy of a local site and its community needs.
And yet the original developers, if you will, of Quincy Market did not realize the gain that that the new Quincy Market generated. So you had the building over time in decline and then rejuvenated with the new market. So what's the original developer's incentive to think long-term?
Well, the development cycles as they are right now are highly accelerated. Developers are increasingly thinking about how they can get the return on their money within a certain development life cycle. So instead of thinking that one's going to get the return, let's say, over a 30-year period, it could be 20 years, 15 years. In some cases, depending on the building type, as short as 5 to 10 years. That puts enormous pressure on the developer to come up with an economic model that works. So let's say you do come up with a development model that works within a 5 or 10-year period, a 5-year or 10-year return. Wouldn't it be great to be able to have a building that could have a second life or a third life with relatively small investment so that you could get then a higher return in the subsequent generations or regeneration of certain buildings and developments. So there's, I think, a competitive advantage in developers who are thinking not only about the immediate needs and return on their investment, but thinking about how this can generate value over the future.
One of the questions being raised by many suburban communities is how to retrofit their communities to build a core or a town center. How hard is that to do?
Well, I think it very much depends on the context, where the core is, what is it working with in relationship to existing buildings, where the rest of the community is located. It depends very much on the region of the country, and there are some regions of the country where there have already been, let's say, 100, 200 years of development. There may be a remnant of a core that just needs to be revitalized, in which case it's easier to look at the existing building stock and think about how you can create strong streets, a strong sense of public spaces, a strong presence of the landscape. Many of these ideas have already been developed by new urbanists and allied professions, especially landscape architects. The bigger challenge is to think about communities that don't necessarily have a strong existing, let's say, town center or core. Then they have to invent a new one, either in the context of an existing mall or strip mall or areas of that sort. But I think there's the beginnings of those kinds of spaces or those buildings that can be added onto in different ways, where one can think about where the next office development is going, where the next shopping center is going, and so on, and how those buildings collectively over time can begin to develop a more coherent form or form of community. And that's partially what the book is addressing, is sites like that that are messy right now but can evolve over time. See, when we look at many of our, let's say, at least some of my favorite historic communities, let's say whether they're Europe, the United States, or Asia, there's a certain quality about those places that are quite amazing. And you know when you go there that they have this kind of relationship between the community, the landscape, and the history that evolved. And what I think we have to realize today is that we're just at the very beginning stages of developing a whole new kind of urban or suburban form. And we're at the very early stage. This form is only 50 years old for all practical purposes. And with the right moves, with thinking about how the forms can evolve over time, I believe we can create places that will be truly memorable, that our communities and members of our communities can look back in the future and say, you know, I grew up in such and such a place, and that was a great place, and it was great for these and these reasons. It had a great landscape. It had a great town center. It had a place where our kids could play. It had places where we could live. We could get to town quickly, and yet we could still do all the things that we needed to do in our daily lives, but do it in a way that was more sustainable. It was not taking away from the natural resources in a way that would punish future generations. And so that's our hope, that we can somehow look at these places and start to change them and create centers and communities that we're all proud of.
Let's talk about first steps. If a community is at that point to say, we want to change this place, we want to transform this place, what's the first step?
Well, I think one of the first steps is to figure out what the community mandate is, and that is identifying who are the key stakeholders in that community. And it can be the residents of the community. It can be the residents and the institutions. It can be the major corporations that are in that community. It's taking an assessment of who's there, who has an interest in this community, what is the vision of this community, what are the shared values of this particular community. And then secondly, working with professionals, working with planning departments, working with all the resources available at neighboring universities and so on, and using the latest technologies, we can begin to start mapping and trying to understand what's special about our place. And what's really surprising through this mapping process is we can not only begin to understand the history of each one of our communities, but we can understand underlying qualities, sort of the latent characteristics of a place that might have been paved over recently or may not be as visible or obvious to residents. And then we can make an assessment of what those qualities are of place and how we might be able to build upon them in the future. And then the idea is to think about think of ourselves as almost filmmakers. When I say ourselves, I mean the community and the developers, the planners, the whole collection of members that go into making each community, and thinking about how can we shape this community of the future? How can we, if we were to make a film of what our place is going to look like in the future, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in the future, what might it look like in the future? And what types of investments need to be made now? What type of and strategic developments need to happen over time to make and realize that community? So it's using all the tools that are available to us, and we have tremendously powerful tools available to us now, whether through GIS. Anybody can go to Google Map, for instance, find all kinds of great information about their community. We can begin to assimilate this information, process it, and think intelligently about how we can use our resources as best we can to meet the future objectives.
Paul Lucas is author of Suburban Transformations. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. How are your time management skills these days? CityView's commentator Walker Smith offers one suggestion. Take off your watch.
Recently, I quit wearing a watch when I run. It's been quite liberating. No longer am I running against the clock. Now I'm just running. And when I'm finished, I don't have to deal with a slow time diminishing the satisfaction of an invigorating run. I simply don't know how fast or slow I run anymore because I quit wearing a watch. Now, all I know is that I finished. In fact, I've started putting away clocks everywhere I can. TV shows and airline flights are about the only things anymore that tether me tightly to a clock. I've discovered that just about everything else can be well managed without a minute-by-minute accounting of my life. And this was a surprise discovery to me. I have long been a fanatic about deadlines and time pressures. Being late, even when it didn't matter, was as bad as doing a poor job. I fretted over every second and felt lost if I found myself with an hour free of anything pressing to finish. The clock was the only measure of the quality of my life. But no longer. Now, this is not to say that there is anything wrong with being a good steward of time. Wasting time is still a bad thing in my book. Being productive and useful still matters a lot. Meeting crucial deadlines is no less important than ever. But nowadays, I try to put this time pressure in its proper context, rather than allowing it to dominate my life. I can't confess to any epiphany or transformative moment that changed my thinking about time. I have just learned from experience that more often than not, the more we try to speed up our lives, the slower we go, and thus the more frustrated we become. We rush to work every morning alone in our cars, trying to start our weekdays only to spend time stuck in rush hour traffic, doing nothing but inching together tightly to keep our place in line. We become masters of time management technologies only to find that as a result, all of our time gets spent managing our schedules and fielding phone calls and emails 24/7. We squeeze as much as we can into every hour of every day, only to discover that pretty soon we have squeezed the life out of our lives. I like to be busy. My life is fuller and happier the more engaged I am in the things that I work on and pursue. Nothing makes time more enjoyable than a busy life. But being in the flow of what you do, as social scientists like to put it, is not the same as letting the clock dominate your life. There is a tyranny of time that we unwittingly put in control of our lives when scheduling is the driver of our days and the primary factor in the ways we spend our time. That's why I no longer wear a watch when I run. I'm not trying to master the moment anymore. I want the moment to master me. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.